than Izzy's Weekly ever did. Readers of the Weekly felt this personal connection to Izzy during some of the dark times. He was like their personal Washington bureau chief. And Democracy Now! Viewers and listeners feel that same personal connection to Amy today. When New York University convened scholars, prominent journalists to choose the 100 greatest works of journalism in the United States in the 20th century, number 16 on the list was I.F. Stone's Weekly. If we survive this century, I have no doubt that Democracy Now! Will be near the top of the list for the 21st century, and that's why tonight we officially induct Amy Goodman into the I.F. Stone Hall of Fame.
Congratulations to Amy on your induction into the Hall of Fame. Much deserved.
Well, thanks, Juan. And I consider that an award for all of Democracy Now! And all of its supporters as well. As we head out on our 100 city tour, today we'll be at Columbus, Ohio, at The Ohio State University. Check our website. I'll be speaking on Saturday in St. Louis, Columbia, and Kansas City, Missouri on the 9th, Los Angeles and Santa Barbara on the 10th, and then in San Francisco on the 11th at City Arts and Lectures, Palo Alto, Stanford University, and then Santa Clara, both on the 12th.
All right, that was Democracy Now!, and it is 8 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, coming up to Positively Revolting, and I just want to let you know, if you didn't know, that you can follow KBOO on Twitter and join in on conversations and up-to-the-minute updates. Just search KBOO online or on your favorite Twitter app to find us. Learn about station news and find out about recommended events and see what we're talking about, whether it be news, interviews, or music. For instance, Positive Revolt is the Twitter handle for the show Positively Revolting. And they're next right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival will be held this year from July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 4-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the passes, the festival, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF. 2016.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Break our legs, and we say thank you, and the opera's
And good morning. Good morning. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are listening to Positively Revolting here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning we are talking about reproductive justice. We are talking about it's that topic that just keeps coming back because, well, there's always more to be said on it as women's reproductive freedoms and choices are ever more under attack in all various ways. And to help us with this discussion this morning, we are thrilled to be joined with Judith Arcana. She is a writer, poet. Many of her stories, her poems, her essays, her work revolve around reproductive justice and women's choices, both historically and what's happening today and what is to come. So, Judith, thank you ever so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I have to say, Judith, I'm going to just sort of jump into this straight off, as we only have an hour to discuss this.
As opposed to, for instance, the rest of our lives.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so long-time listeners to the show, it's not a surprise to hear that I had worked in a clinic that provided abortion services for a few years in my early 20s. I worked at the Feminist Women's Health Center here in Portland. And in that work, some of the heroes that we had at the clinic as we were learning women's health care and the importance of always making sure that women's choices were safeguarded and protected was the work of the James in Chicago. And come to find out, you know, years later, there's this wonderful writer in our area, and you were a Jane. And so I wanted to just sort of start out with that experience of your history working as a Jane in Chicago. First of all, for people that might not know, what is that?
Okay. I want to say in front, though, to add to what you just said, I used to use the past tense, as you just did. And then another Jane, a very dear friend of mine, said, no, once a Jane, always a Jane. So now I'm training myself to reverse that and say, yes, I am a Jane. I started in the fall of 1970, but that's, you know, like so many things that started earlier in life, they're still on. For folks, as Ani just said, who may not know, in Chicago in the late 60s and early 70s, a small group of women created what was essentially an underground illegal operation that turned into a clinic, starting out with referrals, finding people who would do abortions, helping women get to those people. And then over time, learning to counsel those women, and then along the way, actually learning to do abortion procedures ourselves. One of our best guys, and of course, no one will be surprised to know that they were guys, and he taught us. He taught one or two Janes. I still remember some of the things he said to me because it was huge, you know, this thing that we had undertaken. And others of us, and then those of us who were learning from him taught others. And eventually he retired. The mob was after him anyway. You know, both the police and the mob in every city in the United States want a cut of anything that's illegal, whether it's drugs or during Prohibition, booze, you know, whatever it is, certainly abortion services when and where abortion's illegal. And so our guy, this wonderful man who was so skilled and treated the women so decently, was always having to defend himself against those two large entities that wanted a cut of the action. So he was, in a sense, happy to teach us and move on. Also, he liked what we were doing, and he liked us, and we liked him. So we were very, very lucky to find him. And then we went on as a self-sustaining, self-teaching organization, all underground, mind you. And then some months, I think somewhere between 2 and 4 months after the Roe decision in January of 73, the service dissolved itself. Some of the women who had begun with Jane work went on to become medical professionals of one sort or another, or legal professionals of one sort or another. I myself thought that I might become a midwife, but you know, once an English major, always an English major. I was fated to be the writer I am. But for a while, I did a certain amount of that work, teaching and so on. So there's a tiny, tiny history of a deep thing.
Yeah. It is. And so just, I mean, again, in a scratching a surface, because the work of Jane's and the work of women's healthcare activists in the 70s and the 80s was really, a lot of it was to demystify the pathology of what is a very natural part of many women's lives, that is their reproductive health.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And when that was sort of usurped into the hands of professionals, you know, taken out of the midwife's hands, taken out of the wise woman down in the village square, you go and you talk to her and you figure out what you need to do, you know, that all of a sudden that really marked a loss of agency for women.
Yes.
You know, so all of a sudden to have basic autonomy and to control our reproduction, you know, we had to seek this professional help that was controlled, you know, by men.
Yes, yes. And also, the wise woman, of course, knew which plants were good for contraception, which plants were good for abortion, which plants were good to heal from a miscarriage, which herbs to use before, during, and after childbirth experiences. And a lot of that was lost and had to be retrieved in that period. Also, so the old stuff had to be brought back, and some new stuff, including self-help, which we were talking about, people out there listening, we were talking before the show began about learning how to examine our own bodies, learning to not be afraid to examine our own bodies, not to believe that our bodies were in some way really only in the hands of the medical industry, and we had to go to them in order to figure out who physically and physiologically we were. Certainly my experience in Jane disabused me of that folly, and I'm pretty happy about it to this day now that I am an entry-level old person and I need to know yet more stuff about the body, this body, everybody, and specifically mine. Yeah, definitely, Ani.
That medical people are here for to help us, not rule us.
Yeah, exactly. There's a bumper sticker. I
right.
like it. Yes.
Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you very much.
We'll work with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so I want to sort of maybe go on that theme a little bit more about the control of women and through the regulation of the medical industry and through making reproductive health care a series of hoops, really, to jump through, right? Or to
yes.
not even attain. You know, we just take it away, you know, period, depending on who holds sway at the moment in the legislative, you know, decisions. So I wanted to sort of look at that theme. What access to abortion, what access to contraception, what access to reproductive health care means to women. I mean, without it, we lose autonomy and agency and basically are controlled by biological destiny. You know, so with that, I wanted to sort of look at what really is the motivating factors behind those that would legislate this control over women. And you have this wonderful piece of writing
from
Azine, and I'll go ahead and let you introduce that. I think it illustrates the point far better than I'm going to ramble about. So just if you could.
Okay, sure. Yes, this is a zine. It's called Keisha and Joni and Jane, and it was published right here in Portland at Eberhardt Press by the wonderful and amazing Charles Overbeck, the publisher. And let me put in a plug here. It's often available at Powell Small Press section downtown. Definitely go to my website, juditharcana.com, of course, and find where to get here in town and online the any various things that we three mention here or that you might elsewise be looking for. Okay, so in this zine that Ani mentioned, a group of women, young women, in the near future, let's say sometime in the next few years, certainly before 2020, Roe v. Wade has been overturned. The Supreme Court has changed its mind, minds plural, and these young women are looking to create, and they're in Portland, Oregon, not in Chicago, because I'm in Portland now, so of course I wrote the story that way. These young women want to meet with their elders and talk about how to set up a service, something like or based on or rooted in the history of women who've done this illegally. And by the way, I need to say, I literally need to say that the Janes are not unique. We certainly were the only ones doing what we did in the United States, as near as we've been able ever to find out. But women have been doing this against the law or sneaking out from under the oppressive constraints on us all over the globe, like forever. And Jane was one extraordinary, and I'm happy to have been a part of it, manifestation, but by no means sui generis. Okay, so in this book, in this zine, the young women are talking with the elders who have come to visit, whole business about how that happens. It's in the zine. Get the zine. Read the zine. And one of the young women says, in a conversation slash discussion slash argument they're having, "All right, you guys, all right. As long as we're doing biology, philosophy, and psych 101, and maybe science fiction or fantasy lit, I've got a question. I'm serious when I ask this. Don't think I'm not. I mean, I'm a medical student, and I'm straight, and I'm 26 years old, and I've had classes with the most poisonously anti-abortion prof at OHSU, and I've got a grandmother who's a far-right Christian. She freaked when I did clinic defense in high school. But I have never been able to figure out where all this comes from." Bernie stands up and keeps talking. "I mean, why do they think the way they do? Why did the U.S. anti-abortion movement happen? What's really bothering them? I've studied this history, so I know that nobody else in any other country at any other time ever created a homegrown anti-abortion movement on anything like this scale. And we know all their pro-life talk is fake. That's not what they're about. Their movement's not against the death penalty. They're not against war or police shoot to kill. They don't say a word about torture. They don't care much about poverty. They haven't set up a system to take care of abandoned kids." She stops to take a big breath here. "And lots of them don't like contraception either. So they don't seem to want women to be able to prevent unplanned pregnancy. They don't even seem to be working to clean up the planet. They're not stopping that kind of destruction of life. So what is it really that makes them hate abortion so much? I'm serious. What is it? This drives me crazy. And besides, I have to know what to tell my daughter." And after Bernie makes this impassioned speech, the other women all jump in the way any group of people do. And one says, "They hate women, and abortion's all about women." Another one says, "Oh, don't be silly. Lots of them are women. So what? Haven't you ever heard of internalized oppression?" Another woman says, "They don't hate women consciously. They've just learned from really old ideas sometimes, maybe most of the time, to devalue and despise women, including themselves, if they are women." I think she's right. I think women, and especially female sexuality, are still damned, blamed, considered. So that's the passage, Ani, that you've asked for.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you went ahead and read that passage, because, again, what is this lie of being pro-life? Because we know that that's not true, for all of the reasons that you have so eloquently listed in that. To me, when I was sort of searching and trying to, you know, come to terms with this world as a teenager, I thought, well, that's cool. You know, there are some principled people who want to take the stance, and I kind of understand it because, you know, I'm a teenager and life seems very sacred and precious, and nuances of control and that sort of thing. Maybe I hadn't quite gotten to them yet because I'm like 15, you know. And then I started really looking at the other things that the same group of people were not fighting or were in fact advocating. When I started doing clinic defense and I started getting to know a specific group of anti-choice forced birthers, as I've come to call them recently, I would see the same group of people at pro-war rallies. Uh-huh. And I thought, okay, this is no longer to do with a principled life is sacred moment. This is all about control. Yeah. It's about domination. It's about usurping women's agency.
Well, and yeah. You need more cannon fodder.
Well, there's that, right?
Definitely.
You know, there's probably a connection there that's a little nefarious.
One of the things I've thought about over decades is when are the times, just thinking about the United States now, when are the times that the mommy booms get really big? And before the draft ended, it was inevitably connected exactly the way you just said, Lynn. After that, I thought, well, now, wait a minute. They have to volunteer now. There are not great thousands of bunches of people who are forced into becoming part of the military. And
they're forced for different reasons now. Economic reasons.
Absolutely. Well, and definitely poverty is a tremendous force behind that. I also thought of this, though, and I'm not saying this is the only thing by any means, but it struck me that now it's about making consumers rather than making members of the military. It's making people to buy things because that's really the ethos of the United States. This is a capitalist country. This is a country in which people are referred to as consumers much more often than we are referred to as citizens.
Yes.
People all over the world. I remember reading a Doris Lessing story about this watch where Americans come with their babies. And the amount of stuff that they have with them. We can't, nobody can just carry their baby off on a trip. There have to be
You must
carriages.
Accessorize your baby.
Oh, and it really expensive, you know, carriages and toys and the right the carrier and the la la la.
Yeah, and I was pretty stunned when I began to think about and look at that. I mean, it's not that there's an equivalency, but I thought, oh no.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to go ahead and open up the conversation to listeners to join us this morning. The number is 503-231-8187. Would love to hear from some women this morning. As we've noticed, the last few weeks have been a little, you know, heavy in male voices, which is great. We love all listeners, but really, we're putting a little call out for women to share our experiences, to share our stories, and to join in this conversation especially. And also, I want to let people know that next Tuesday, April 12th, as part of the Reproductive Health Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater, Reproductive Film Series, I guess it's just called, they will be showing Jane An Abortion Service, which is a documentary about Janes, and Judith will be speaking at that screening next Tuesday at the Clinton Street Theater. That's at 7:00.
Yeah, and I'll talk a little, I'll read a little, and we'll do, you know, just conversation. The audience, me, and one of the members of Backline, who they co-sponsor the film series along with the Clinton Street. So Charlie and I will be there together, hanging out, watching the movie. The movie's about an hour long, and it's an interesting thing, too. The film was made in the early to mid-90s. The service operated in the late 60s and early 70s. Now it's 2016. And that's one of the, and I will surely say that same thing again on Tuesday. Day, folks. I think it's really interesting to think about and useful to think about those three periods of history and the focus on reproductive justice, women's reproductive health, and the constraints that we're talking about and the punishments that follow when people break through those constraints. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you know, in my work in the late 80s at the clinic, we were so, it felt so sure that we were moving forward in this, right?
Sure.
That we were strong, that Roe was established. It had been there for, 13 years, 12 years, something. Seemed like ancient history for somebody in their early 20s, taking on this work. And to have watched this pendulum swing and swing and swing.
Certainly a lesson in impermanence.
It is that. I think part of the conversation this morning is I'd love to hear your opinion on the rights that have been established and where we're at now in the rollback, in the attainment, as your writings often do, look at our history and our present. Where is this heading? What are we needing to do to safeguard our access to abortion and to contraception, for that matter?
Well, I think that what we're needing to do, we in the largest possible sense actually are doing, which is very heartening. It's an uphill battle. Obviously, they won a few decades back and continue to. They being the bad guys, us being the good guys, and they run it. They run the language. They run the vibe, so that the mindset around abortion, contraception, motherhood, in fact, in the United States, has been designed and defined by the anti-abortion movement and its allies. Sometimes far right, sometimes not so far. Although the current political climate is so insane. Who could have predicted the level of insanity around the presidential politics?
Not
a
long
time. No, no one could have made... Well,
if I thought about it with reality TV, I would have said, oh, yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah?
If I
well,
was,
good
I mean,
for
in,
you.
I don't watch reality TV, but the little bits that I see, I'm like, well, if you keep putting this stuff out there... But it's
life
also,
imitates art.
If you
or
call that art,
right?
If you call that art, I don't.
Anti-art.
Anyway, yeah. Yes, no, I agree.
Yeah. So it is fairly insane. But setting aside if we can do such a thing, just for the sake of this brief conversation this morning, the utter insanity of the moment. I think that we have to. I think it will be helpful for us to realize that we are on the defensive. They won a while back. And what we need to do is is embrace the uphill struggle. And I'm really serious about that. I know it sounds like I'm, preachy. But no, there is something about being in that position that fires us up, that saves us from being utterly disheartened. Some of it is anger, literally righteous anger. Like, what are you telling me? What are you saying about motherhood? What are you saying about my feelings about this child that I've been raising for 10 years, or the possibility that I might never want to have a child and it's none of your business and everything in between? What are you saying to me? That's unacceptable. And in the last decade, certainly 5 years, I've encountered so many extraordinary young women of power and strong minds and serious purpose who have embraced what I'm calling that uphill struggle, because they've come up under this anti-woman regime and they are pissed off. Once they're not 10 years old or 12 years old or 15 years old, as you said earlier about yourself, honey, they say, hey, wait a minute, this is not all right. And lucky for all of us, they're smart, they're tough, they're determined. So I am heartened by the presence of angry young women in great numbers and their elders and, including myself, who are on the case, paying attention, working at every level. One of the things I learned decades ago, is that it's good to have the people in the streets. It's good to have the people in the legislature. It's good to have the people who chain themselves to the governor's mansion's front door. It's good, you know, whatever the realm in movement is, we need all of them. You can't make serious change, with very rare exceptions, without all of that stuff fomenting and moving in its various ways. And I think that that is happening now in movement work for not only women's rights, but the integrity and depth of the lives of women and girls who may or may not choose to become mothers, and who need to have knowledge about their bodies, about making decisions about their bodies, about making decisions about whether to make more people. I mean, for instance, now, decades on, the question of what does it mean to make more people on the earth at this time, when the earth is already under such stress from the way we have abused it, and the questions of overpopulation, and to say nothing of climate change. What does it mean to make that decision? That's an element that wasn't even part of the decisions that we were all making in the 50s, 60s, and 70s when we were deciding whether or not to make people. Now it's even deeper, even wider and broader. Well, I think I've already answered. I'll pause here and go back to you two.
Well, I just want to let
you were on a roll, and I was enjoying.
I know. We weren't going to interrupt that. I'll tell you what. So you are listening to KBOO. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Lynn. I'm here with my friend Ani and our new friend Judith Arcana, who is a poet, a teacher, and what she's talking about. We're talking about her. We're talking about reproductive rights once again, yet again, because we have to. There's a movie about the Janes, who, you know, I was part of, like I said, out in DeKalb, not in Chicago. But thank you for reminding me about the Janes, because and it is not the Indian religion.
This is different.
J-A-N-E. The movie about the Janes will be at the Clinton Street this Tuesday at 7 o'clock. Judith will be speaking. Who else is going to be speaking?
Charlie from Backline. That's two, right, of us will be the live present in the room with you people,
which is always really fun. That's great.
Oh yeah, it's cool to have the combo to show the movie and then have people there to talk, and in my case also maybe read a bit, and then, you know, talk with the folks in the audience, not just at the audience.
And so probably we're gonna take some callers soon, but I really want to unpack Roe v. Wade a little bit, because you had some insight about that I had never heard before. That's because you read it.
I did. I read the decision. I'm not saying it's fun to read the decision.
Right.
But
since you did, thank you very much. And you get to share that with us.
I wish I'd brought that text with me, but there are major points that I remember.
Excellent.
Yes.
Should we talk to Norm?
Let's talk to Norm.
He's been patient. Thanks,
Good morning, Norm.
Hi. I love your show, Ani and Lynn. You know, like, as a boy, I'm wondering how I could best help specifically in this struggle.
Work on your stuff.
Well, I think beyond that, helping others. It's like when the discussion around abortion comes up, when the discussion around women's autonomy comes up, when the discussion around women's sexuality comes up, and these come up in various ways. They're not always like, oh, now we are sitting around in the office and having a philosophical discussion of the political ramifications of women's sexuality. You know, it's usually not that blatant, right? But talk to your brothers about women's autonomy, about the importance of reproductive justice, and make sure that opinion is ever present as an ally. That's, I think, some of the biggest work.
Uh-huh.
Also, when there are marches, demonstrations, any street actions, it's not a bad thing to have some guys on the scene. Listen to what the women and girls are saying, and tell other men and boys what you've heard, what you've learned from those women and girls. And of course, if you're ever in a position to give any money, $10, $5, $1,000, whoever you are, give it to abortion funds. There's a national network, and here in Oregon is the Network for Reproductive Options, which is our local slash regional outfit to help women and girls to pay for the medical services they need, which are often out of reach for them. It's very specific stuff like that as well. And thinking, and of course, I completely agree with what's been said before, too.
And finally, Judith, how do you spell your name? I'd like to Google you.
Okay. Judith, J-U-D-I-T-H, Arcana, A-R-C-A-N-A.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
And there's a link to Judith's website on the Positively Revolting site on KBOO's page, so you can look at that, kboo.fm/positively revolting. And there are links that'll take you to Judith's site as well as to the event next Tuesday at the Clinton Street Theater. Thanks, Norm. Also, for folks that want to follow along at home throughout the week, not just today, you can do that on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook, Positively Revolting. You can also follow along in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. And again, more information about Judith's site, as well as the upcoming event at the Clinton Street, which is next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Both links can be found there as well. So, where do we go from here? Lynn, you had questions.
People think of Roe v. Wade as that it legalized abortion. I always thought that it was about privacy between the doctor and patient. And you had some other comments about that, Judith. So, spill.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, of course, it is about privacy, which in itself is not the greatest for women and girls. But also, one of the things, perhaps the most important thing that I learned when I actually read the text of the decision, and as I say, I'm not recommending that everybody whip it out and read it from the library, but wouldn't hurt, but
you could probably get it online.
Oh, it's absolutely online. Mm-hmm. And check the highlights. And what you learn is that the decision does not actually put power in the hands of women. It puts power in the hands of the medical industry, which is, of course, exactly where the power was anyway. And the medical industry did not agitate for that decision, did not agitate to change abortion law. They went along with it when they were given the power. I mean, I've also read stuff about the politics of who influenced whom and how in those days. But the decision itself, if you read the text, you find it does not say anything about a woman making decisions about her own life being the law. It's all about the doc. It's all about doctors and their power and rights in relation to the needs of women as quote-unquote patients, which is an interesting term anyway when you think about what it means to work with medical folk, to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
To be patient. Every now and then, and this has actually happened to me a couple times in the last few years, I meet the most wonderful doctors. I mean, like, spectacularly wonderful doctors. And I think, oh my God, how did you get in? You know, I'm so glad they let you in. You're a full human as well as a rep of the industry. I have a jaundiced view, and I got it in my work as a Jane.
You got it honestly, yes.
Yeah, I came by it in a righteous way. Yeah. So that's really the main thing, Lynn, that I think that folks should be looking for and thinking about when they examine the text of the Roe decision. Also, another thing that we talked about before we went on air is that having a Supreme Court decision, in a sense, cut off the actual political action state by state that was already happening in the country. And probably it seemed like a good idea. Probably it seemed like a shortcut. Probably. And of course, Sarah Weddington was a wise, beyond her years, young woman. She was smart. She was gutsy. She put that case together with her team. I have come to feel that it really wasn't the best way to go, and that state by state would have been better, or perhaps even national legislation, but it did cut off populist action toward reproductive justice. And as I say, put the power actually in the hands of the medical industry rather into the hands and the lives of women and girls.
Thank you for that clarification.
Let's go ahead. I have this other question I just want to get to. And seeing time runs out quickly, I'm going to get to it now. What is it, Judith, about women's sexuality that is so very frightening to the status quo that it must be controlled at all costs?
This may seem hokey to some of our listeners, or perhaps to you too. I mean, I don't know. To me, this is the contemporary manifestation of the eons old, centuries and centuries old, since the rise of the patriarchy on the planet, fear of women's power. Women, you know, think about long ago when people didn't know where babies come from. And here are these creatures, the female of the species, every now and then they will just get really, really, really big. And then a person comes out of their bodies. Right. And the guys on the team thought, whoa, what's that? They are the deal. Uh-huh. You know? Oh, my God. Or my goddess, as the case may be.
Right.
And so if you look back at the ancient religions all over the planet, not just in the ones people study in school in the United States, Greek and Roman mythology, but everywhere, the Pacific Islands, the middle of Africa, everywhere, women were worshipped, venerated, and part of what that was about was the fact that they made life. No one understood that you needed the sperm and the egg to get together. When they figured that out, things were still okay for a while. But then the male of the species began to think, well, and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. So I think that the contemporary manifestation is still related to that, and that there has to be a lid on that. That has to be tamped down. So that's one part of it. And another is the generic, now all too common, again, global reality that it's been so long that women and girls have been either openly despised or simply negated in terms of achieving full human power that people are sort of used to it. Women actually, last year in Portland, and of course in many other cities all over the planet, there were showings of a film called She's Beautiful When She's Angry. And it's about women's movement in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s. And one of the women in the movie says that when she was working for women to get, this was in, like, let's say 1969, 1970, 71, she was working for equal pay. And she said, women, not just men, women would say to her in a very serious way, not nasty, do you really think that? Do you think that women should get paid the same as men? Whoa, really? Now, think about what that means, mm-hmm. about what people think about gender/sexual differences in the human species. Do you think, whoa, what a concept.
Right.
As if women were not human. Or as if human were not the point. It's male and then others. So it's incredibly complex. We're obviously not going to get it all done this morning. But I think of the ancient history and I think of stuff like that and cite this most recent conversation that I heard in this documentary film.
One teeny little thing. As a hairdresser, I charge men the same as women. Oh my God, you would think, they're like, what?
Uh-huh.
I don't
That's
get the $20.
Or
you used to be able to have, sure, if you took your shirts to the dry cleaner, men got a much cheaper deal than women. I mean, those are just like little microaggressions. But
absolutely.
Still, and insane.
I love that you bring up the commercial world because one of the things that always pisses me off is pockets. Men get more pockets and they are literally, as well as metaphorically, deeper pockets. Pockets on women's clothing are like some kind of little frill.
You don't need much in there, honey.
You can't.
It's an add-on.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And when women were, I remember clearly, I was born in the middle of World War II. And when I was growing up, it was the 50s. I was in high school. And I was told by the mother raising me, never go out without pin money. Pin money. And what that meant was folding paper money that you would pin inside your clothes in case you needed to pay for something on your own.
Well, or I was cleaning houses at one point in my life, and I remember one of the women say, but you're just doing this for pin money after all.
And yeah. I was like, yeah, like yeah, for groceries.
Like pin the groceries to my chest, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, it was in the, gosh, it was the 6th century when it was declared that women had no souls. You know, just to point out, we have, I think, possibly come a ways since then, but it was a ways getting there too. I mean, you know, from the egalitarian society's pre-patriarchy to women have no souls suddenly in the 6th century.
And, thanks, and even before the church announced this, Aristotle had this theory, had to be theory, because of course he couldn't have known that the male fetus is ensouled at a different time than the female fetus.
Of course, what was I thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Should have known. Oh,
yeah.
Well.
Check him out,
boy,
Aristotle.
We know where he pulled that one out of, but we can't say it on the air.
Let's go ahead and let's talk to a caller, shall
all right,
we? We'll bring
all right.
in more people to the conversation. Good morning, Hugh. You are on the air.
Thank you very much for this program. There's much more to be said after that reference to the ancient goddesses. She's quite right in what she said. It's a long story, but it's true. I have a suggestion for a tactic which perhaps no one has thought of yet, or have they? There's a lot of pressure here and there against those states and communities that are passing anti-LGBT legislation. Why not talk to corporations and councils, such as our Portland City Council, and get them to boycott or restrict paid travel to those states and cities that are passing these anti-abortion legislations?
Because it's most of the states.
It's doing much more harm than the anti-LGBT legislation. Please, I'm not against promoting LGBT rights, but these anti-abortion laws that are popping up all over the place, this is doing vast damage to the women of the United States. Has anybody thought of a tactic, a boycott tactic?
Well, here's the thing, Hugh. I agree, they are doing great harm, but Oregon is one of like 3 states that haven't passed these. So that's the thing. We'd be pretty much isolating ourselves, and I'm not sure, in terms of economic boycott, it's not a real strong position to start from. So the problem is far more ubiquitous than your solution may give rise to.
I think that it's it's interesting. I think it should be on the list. You're not wrong. I think that it
Absolutely.
Is interesting for us here in Oregon to think about what it means that this is, I think actually at this point, Ani, the only state at the moment, who knows what's happening in the halls of legislature or the byways right now, this is the only state that has not yet passed a law that in some way limits women's access to abortion health care. And what that means is that, as in the past, women must travel. And I think limiting the incoming travel could be a dicey business, but it's definitely worth examining on the political level and for the PR value. So anyway, that's the first thing that's off the top of my head to that suggestion.
All right, and we have we're almost running out of time. We just 15 minutes left. Let's go ahead and talk to Johnny. Good morning, Johnny. You're on the air.
Good morning. So I just have a couple of really quick things I want to put out there. First being just a recognition for the feminine spirit and the feminine soul. I have a masculine body, but I recognize with a feminine spirit and soul. And second thing is that a little known fact that very little people know that Dr. Something Vagina was the person who named that specific body part. It was a guy that named it, and it was named after him. And there are, and one thing I wanted to point out, some topics for our male listeners, for the guy listeners out there, for my brothers, that there have been studies done that prove that the event of competition in our society leads to a disconnection of our feelings, and it enhances an obsession over whatever is put in our face at in the moment. And what I think we can all agree that sexuality is sold on the market, and feminine sexuality is sold on the market. So it has resulted into, like, the state of competition in America has resulted to men being obsessed with sex. And so I kind of want to put it out there to the fellow masculine out there that one way you can support women is to just be aware of this, and also stand up for women when you see things that are happening, like if somebody makes degrading remarks about women, or the little subtle jokes, you know, like, yeah, stand up and just say something. You know, you don't have to be rude. Just be kind and be compassionate and try to change that identity. You know, use your mouth, brothers.
Hey, Johnny, thank you so much for your call morning. Totally appreciate it, though I am going to say one thing, and that is the etymology of the word vagina actually comes from the Latin, which it's the same root for sheath, scabbard, that sort of thing. And it's been in medical terminology for, you know, 500 years or so in that way. But thanks very much for your call this morning. I just wanted to clear that up, because word etymology is one of those near and dear to my heart sort of things. I love that stuff. So there we go. Let's go ahead, take another call, shall we? 503-231-8187. Also following along on Facebook, where we have almost 700 followers.
Weehaw!
So please do join our community online, Positively Revolting on Facebook, or Positive Revolt in the Twitterverse. And I think we have John. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Great show. And thanks for educating me. And I'm sorry, too many males, right?
You know, but you're here, and that's great. Thanks, John.
Oh, yeah. I've been a supporter of Equal Rights Amendment. I think that if that would pass, things might be better. But I'm also a big proponent of everything to me is political. So I think it's so important that all of us, and especially women, encourage each other and help each other to register to vote, because you are 51-52% of the population. And if you don't vote, you lose power. And I hope every time that you have a political get-together for anything, that people would be helping women to vote and getting them registered to vote. To me, that's a secret if we want a nonviolent revolution. And
thank you very much. Hey, John. Thank you so very much.
Take care now.
Bye-bye. You too. And let's, we have another call. I'm looking for names. Good morning.
With Rebel?
It's
Reagan.
Reagan. Hello. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning, you're on Reagan. The air. You were on the air, yes.
Oh, I'm on the air.
Yeah.
It's that moment.
Oh, hello. I don't know how helpful it will be, but I had an abortion in 2007, and, it was incredibly traumatic. I felt alone, and I Googled, services and help, and Planned Parenthood was amazing, But there was just nothing there. It was all negative and shaming and guilty and pictures and, you know, there. It just wasn't helpful.
At Planned Parenthood?
No. Planned Parenthood was amazing, but when you Google services, it's all negative.
Oh, yeah.
Then, I mean, I haven't revisited.
Well, and this
option, you know, but
right, and it kind of that also goes into the whole crisis pregnancy center scam, where you know, it's really hard for women to access health services without the shaming components.
Exactly.
And that's wrong. That's just wrong.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, my family is, I'm from upstate New York, so my family is very conservative in a small town way, which I think that there are different kinds of conservative ideals, and small town country conservative is very different. So no one in my family knows about it, and I'm not ashamed or guilty, but they just wouldn't understand. And I don't tell a lot of people. There's a lot of, for the same reasons that probably people don't share, it's you get a lot of, well, I can't have children. You know, why would you choose not to if you could? And, you know, it's, and I'm an educated person. You know, I have my bachelor's degree. And
well, no one wants to be shamed.
Exactly. Yeah. And
that I know of.
You're educated. You're in your 30s. Like, why wouldn't you want to have a child? There was a man that loved you. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. What you're saying reminds me of when I began writing both poems and stories, and of course essays, about reproductive justice and abortion access, because one of the things I did here in Portland was ask folks for access to clinics. I wanted to see what the abortion experience was like, compare it to my history, my Jane work from the late 60s and early 70s. And the thing that was most striking to me, the women who came in were asked if it would be all right with them if I was in the room and assisted. And the ones who said yes, and there were several, let me in. And the clinic folk spoke with me at length. And what I found is exactly what you are talking about. The level of shame was intense. It was so heavy. I was shocked because we were illegal. We were on the run, so to speak, metaphorically, but people were not ashamed. And the shame I learned in that period, in the last 15 years, my learning, it's been going on for a longer time, and clearly with you, 2007, right in the middle of it, is a result of the anti-abortion movement's media, PR, language choices. That shame was brought on us, so to speak, by the anti-abortion movement. Women were frightened in 1970. Women were nervous. Women were anxious. Women were worried about the money. But there was not the sense that abortion itself would be, should be, could be a source of shame. And here it is. Here it is. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you a lot,
talking
Megan.
About that. It's yeah, important.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I just wanted to say, too, I mean, I don't know if anyone has ever, I mean, I called in a little late, but just the crossing a picket line outside
yes.
of a Planned Parenthood, like, it's the most, you know, I mean, I for 3 weeks, you know, I sat on it, like, should I do this, and I knew the whole time that I didn't want to, but I was trying to want to have a baby, and so it's just, you know, they're yelling at you, and they called my, at the time, partner, you know, a coward, and it was really traumatic. And so just the feeling in the room, and I don't know if people talk about this, but it's just, it's a horrifying experience.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you for talking about it.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you very much, Regan, for your call this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, I started my work at the health center. I hadn't actually thought about becoming a lay health worker or a medical assistant or, you know, the person that actually inserts laminaria and second trimester abortions. You know, I hadn't thought about that. I had thought I need to be a volunteer clinic escort to get women from the bus stop into the building with the most minimum amount of harassment mm-hmm. from this group of absolutely vile, hate-filled people. Who would yell the most horrendous things.
Yeah.
And it was in my work doing that I ended up finding the rest of the work and being fascinated with it.
Yeah.
Judith, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
The hour has flown by. I knew
Indeed.
It would.
Yes.
I want to invite people to stay tuned to KABU because at 9 o'clock we're going to hear from Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. They'll be speaking on privacy and surveillance. We also want to thank all KABU members for your generous support. If you're not yet a KABU member, you can take care of that problem right now. Go to kboo.fm and support us. Your support is how we do what we do. So thank you all for being a part of the show this morning. Again, next Tuesday night, you can hear Judith Arcana speak again at the Clinton Street Theater. Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, Jane, An Abortion Story is the documentary that will be shown. Judith and Charlie from Backline will be on hand speaking and discussing this issue. It's hugely important and never-ending issue with the audience. So with that, have a great week, and we'll be back to see you next Friday.
We'll tell the world how you cast your vote.
KABU at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m., KABU at the Clinton will show Who Are My People? Who Are My People is a documentary film which follows four Native American elders as they seek to preserve cultural resources, including large geoglyphs from the building of renewable energy facilities in California's Mojave Desert. Director Robert Lundahl will be in attendance. Again, that's Who Are My People, Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Amish Project, a play running from April 8th through April 24th at the Portland Actors Conservatory.
The Amish Project explores the human effects of tragedy and the profound forgiveness of the Amish after a lone man shot 10 Amish